Rugby Review, episode number 48. And we are here again tonight, joined by our very good friend, Dr. Edward Dutton, a great man who I will be introducing shortly. But before I introduce Ed Dutton, I am going to do my usual introduction to remind people how all of this works. This is being streamed live to YouTube. It is also being streamed live over on RadioAlbion.com, which is run by my good friend Sven Longshanks. If you want to go and support Sven and you want to support Radio Albion, there's a range of great programming over there on a daily basis. So please make sure you do that. Now, if you want to support this show, if you want to support myself, you can make contributions, financial contributions to the show via Entropy. Now, Entropy is live and you can get the link for that on my Twitter, on my Telegram, and also on, well, it's also in the live chat right now, and it's in the show description. So if you sign into Entropy, you can send super chats, you can ask questions, and you can also vote on the questions. So the best questions get voted up, and they get asked every week on the show. So please use Entropy if you want to contribute. If you can't use Entropy, would like to contribute financially in another way, you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com or donate via Bitcoin. Those are the best options. Now, tonight, I've actually lost my little show plan. It had disappeared off my desk. We did announce last week that basically, if you went to the PA website, we were having a few problems. And the problems we were having with the PA website were to do with a security issue. And that security issue has now been solved. And if you go over to, we're having a few problems, actually. Somebody's in the chat saying we are having problems. Sorry about that. But I was going to say, if you go over to the PA website now, it is all fully working. The security certificate has been updated. There wasn't any actual issues with people's data or anything like that. It was just a matter of a security certificate. It took about a week for that to update for some reason. But now everything's working. So www.patrioticalternative.org.uk, you can go there and you can find out all you need to know about Patriotic Alternative. You can read the excellent news articles and you can sign up so you can stay in touch. And the other week, I sent out a large bulletin to everyone who has signed up. So if you haven't got the bulletin, it's probably in your junk mail. So please check that. Now, on Friday of last week, I produced a video about GDP, and it was about how immigration affects GDP in a way that doesn't benefit the indigenous people. Now, I'm following that video up this week with another video about credit. And I've had people writing to me saying, it's all well and good talking about GDP, Mark, but we live in a debt-based economy. What do you say about that? Well, this is a multi-part series, and the second part of that series is coming out this week. Now, there are a lot of things that we're going to discuss this week, and one of the most notable things will obviously be the coronavirus, Boris Johnson being ill, Trump's kind of half-hearted response to the coronavirus. We will also be talking about the horrific case of the young girl in the Manchester area who was brutally murdered by a Somalian, yet the media are covering it up. And we will be talking a little bit about the left's response to Boris Johnson's hospitalisation. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the 5G issue, because people seem to be emailing me a lot about that. People want me to talk about it, so I'm going to. But before we get to any of that, I want to introduce my good friend, No White Guilt. And while he's introducing himself, saying what he's been up to and telling you who's on tap this week, I'm going to try and fix the entropy problem. So here goes.
Well, are we having a StreamYard problem? Can everybody hear me okay? Ed, can you hear me? Yes, Ed can hear me. Well, great. It's great to see him. It's great to have Ed here with us today. Splendid gentleman and very entertaining as well, educational and entertaining. So it's great to have you here. Big welcome to you, good sir. And a big welcome to everyone who is here with us today watching, and those who will watch in replay. Later this week, we will tap into someone and don't exactly know who it is, though, but we might be talking about homeschooling, since a lot of parents are doing that these days, and especially in the United States, children have been sent home, and parents, for the first time, if you can believe it, they're actually cracking those textbooks. What are they teaching our children? Let me have a look in here, because they have to. The schools are requiring them to check in for the rest of the year and say, well, you've taught your little demons X, Y, or Z, and what has it been? What have you taught them that we have given you to teach them? And the parents are discovering that every other page in every single textbook is vehemently anti-white, as if they had no idea. So there, many of these parents are tearing the pages out of the textbooks for the first time, horrified at what their little urchins are being taught at school, and also discovering, by the way, that the little urchins can be, all of the education can be summed up in about an hour to two, and yet the children are there all day long. What the hell are they doing there with their time? Who knows what the anti-whites are having them go through? But rest assured, it's not good for our people and not good for their parents. So make sure you stick with us here. Make sure you let all your friends and family know that if they have questions about what's going on in the world right now and they want to know, why is everything amiss? Why is everything falling out? Why are the terrorists still entering the country? Why are every other page in the textbook is teaching our white children about hating our people, hating our history, hating our parents, hating our ancestry, and hating that we could possibly be present in our civilizations in the future. Why is this happening? Well, you can listen to people like Ed Dutton and Mark Collett and find out a hell of a lot of the reasons why we are in the state that we are today. So very happy to be here, and I pass it back to our great leader, Mark Collett.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to say the Entropy link is now working, and I am spamming it in the live chat. So if you'd like to make a financial contribution, or if you would like to ask a question or vote on existing questions, please do that through Entropy, and we will put all questions to the panel, and we will read out all super chats. That is very much appreciated. So just to let you know, the Entropy link is now working. I don't know what that was. I refreshed the page. It allowed me to start it again, and everything's going fine. I usually try to get these things set up in advance, but we have had a few niggles with Entropy in the past, but it appears to be working correctly. So, without further ado, the man of the moment, Dr. Edward Dutton. He is a very well-spoken man, a very humorous man, a very intelligent man. He was a man that raised the roof at the first PA conference, where his speech was possibly one of the funniest speeches I've ever heard in my life. And I've said this before, but people are often intellectuals or they're funny, and the two very rarely intersect. But Ed manages to be an intellectual, but do it with a large degree of hilarity, which I think makes his message even more powerful. He's an accomplished writer, he's an accomplished streamer, and he truly is a very, very powerful individual who gets our message out to many, many people here on YouTube. I love his channel. If you haven't subbed him, make sure you do too. But Ed's got lots of things to talk about. I believe he's going to talk about a book that he recently released. Is that correct?
Yes, if you will let me. Yes, that's of course.
Go ahead, Ed. Tell us all about it. Hello. And then we'll do the news items when you. Well, tell us all about it. Yes.
Hello, Mr. Mark Collett and Sir No White Guilt. I hope. Thank you for having me on once again. No, I wrote a book which was published earlier this year with Washington Summit Publishers, and it has the sort of does what it says on the tin kind of title of why Islam makes you stupid, but also means you'll rule the world and or conquer the world. And so that was that, really. And basically the essence of it was some research that I did with some colleagues of mine at a university in Saudi Arabia that I do some research for. And we found a very interesting thing, which is that everyone knows there are these race differences in IQ, in intelligence, and that they're probably partly heritable and partly to do with environmental factors. And we know that the IQ in Europe, European countries, is always set at 100. Now, the IQ in these countries in the Islamic world, in Middle Eastern countries, is about 80, something like that, 82. But the interesting thing is it's not 82. It's not 82 among 6 or 7 year olds. Among 6 or 7 year olds, it's something like 95. So it's 5 points lower than the European children. If you put the European children at 100, it's 95 among 6 or 7 year old children in Arab countries. And then as you get older, if you set the British IQ or the European IQ at 100, Their IQ, by comparison, gets lower and lower and lower and lower until they reach about the age of 18, something like that, when their IQ is 75. Now, that's on a par with Africa, with African adults. That's very low. And then by the time they're about 30, it goes back up to 80, 85, something like that. And I thought, well, that's interesting. What's going on here? And equally, I did some research in Kuwait, and I found that when they have a very Islamic government, the IQs go down. And when they have a more sort of liberal westernized government, the IQs go up. And so it struck me that what's happening is there's something about the nature of Islam and of Islamic education and of Islamic dominated societies in a strict fundamentalist sense that reduces IQ, that makes people less intelligent. But then, interestingly, intelligence, low intelligence, correlates with very important aspects of ethnocentrism, of thinking that your group is the best, and in particular, hating outsiders and being prepared to fight outsiders and being able to repel the invader. So the very things in Islam that are making Islamic countries less intelligent are also making them more ethnocentric. And so if we think in terms of group selection, in terms of battles between groups, then one of the reasons why Islam is winning, Islamic world has a higher birth rate than European countries. Their presidents in certain countries in the Islamic world have literally talked about how their women should colonize Europe with their wombs. I think it was the president of Algeria or somewhere that talked about that. Is the nature of Islam itself. It's that it reduces intelligence and therefore it reduces the standards of living in the society, and therefore it makes people more stressed, and this elevates religiousness, and religiousness is correlated with ethnocentrism. And so the nature of Islam is kind of almost a manifesto for a combination of not very high IQ, but very high ethnocentrism. And that is why they are seemingly, in terms of demographics, and also just general sense of their own importance, winning this this battle. And that's what I argued in the book. And this set off a bit of a controversy because some people started saying that, oh, I must be a Muslim and that I'm Muslim sympathizer. Not even that I'm a Muslim sympathizer, but I'm literally a Muslim. And so on. So anyway, that was it. That's the book that I've just had published.
Excellent. Well, that sounds like something everyone should be checking out. Is there anything else you want to say about that, or do you want to give your channel a plug?
I thought it might work that you might ask me some questions about it, and then I might answer them in a kind of back and forth tit for tat over the kitchen table with tea and biscuits sort of thing.
It all depends on what type of tea you like. We've had this before on this show. What kind of tea do you drink? Be very careful here, Edward. My thumb is hovering over the kick from chat button.
I see. Yes, this is an important division for any Americans that are watching this within England. It's really what I was brought up on. I was brought up on Thai food. My parents always had Thai food tea. So, and I'd watch the PG Tips commercials with a little cartoon. It's not my fault. But don't get pissed off. With the little cartoon men, you know, with the kind of Yorkshire accents or whatever they were. I'd watch Tetley Tea. I'd watch some Laura Towler Tea, and I'd watch that, and I'd think, oh, I'd like some of that, Stanley. But no, it wasn't allowed. No, in my house, it was Thai food tea, and so that's what I've got used to. And of course, here living in Finland, they don't have Workman's Tea here. You can't buy it. You can only buy tea in little posh sort of paper containers where you have, you know, it's a kind of a luxury thing almost here, so you have to have something ridiculous like Lipton or something like that. But no, so that's not a choice, obviously. No, it's work. I like Workman's tea with milk, obviously, about third milk, and you know, and then a tea. Yeah, it's Thai food. What about you? What did you used to have?
I drink English breakfast tea. It's a joke, really, because Laura has a specific type of tea that she only drinks. She only drinks Yorkshire tea, and I find Yorkshire tea to be too strong. It's essentially like slop, basically. I can't stand it. But we have disagreements on cheese. We have disagreements on lots of things. Actually, not politically.
Let's hope the patriotic alternative doesn't split over the issue of tea.
Well, that's the question, and she
it
likes
would be like Life of Brian splitting over the shoe and the gourd. I mean, it would be a terrible, terrible thing to have to happen. I had a girl next door to me when I was an undergraduate, and she used to drink Lapsang Souchong tea, and it tasted like public school girl, you know, and it tasted like.
It tasted like public schoolgirl.
I don't know what.
What does a public schoolgirl taste like, Edward?
As you know, unlike you, I didn't go to one. I didn't know. It wasn't on the headmaster's conference. No, but it was like smoke. It was like it tasted like smoke. I don't know how she used to drink the bloody stuff every day. But there you go. But no, the book on Islam. Anyway, if I were to plug that, so that's the key point. There's all these dimensions to Islam which reduce intelligence. So fast. So praying, for example, they pray five times a day. That elevates ethnocentrism because it means that you commune with God and you have a sense of God's existence.
That reduces IQ.
Eh?
Does that reduce IQ? You said.
Well, indirectly, just a minute. It's about you commune with God, and if people are religious, it tends to elevate their sense that their own group is important. So it elevates ethnocentrism. So that's why praying is good in that sense, because there's actually a part of the brain where we know that if you stimulate it, then people become both more ethnocentric and more religious. But if your society is stopping five times a day, every day, then this is interfering with the efficient running of the economy. So it's possible then that indirectly it makes the country slightly poorer, which indirectly makes the education system worse, which indirectly at the environmental level makes you more stupid, but indirectly elevates ethnocentric traits. There's all kinds of other things, like even something like fasting. So fasting, it's going to be interfering with the economy. If they are genuinely fasting, they're not going to be working as hard during Ramadan. They're going to be tired. They're going to be making stupid decisions and whatever. And if the women fast when they're pregnant, which some of them do, then it can damage the baby and it can literally make the baby less intelligent. Female genital mutilation, there are quite a few Islamic cultures that practice this. In Egypt, it's 96% of girls are cut. This traumatizes the girl. So, and if you're traumatized, it reduces IQ. And then you're bringing up the child with your deficient IQ, and consequently the child's IQ is going to be limited as a result, because our IQ is affected by how stimulated we are by other people. And if we're around stupid people, our IQ does not reach its maximum possible level. Purdah, you end up not educating women and locking them away and whatever, a similar kind of effect. And so there's all these. Polygamy is interesting because what polygamy does is it compels a society. In a sense, you could argue that it forces men to want. They demand trust, and polygamy gives them this trust. And once they've got this trust through Purdah, then the society becomes more ethnocentric because you've got trust between men, and men can then cooperate better. So Purdah becomes important to elevating trust. And there's all kinds of other ways. And when Islam moves away from strict Islam under people like Al-Ghazali in the 11th century or whatever, he was very strict Islam, Muslim fundamentalist, but before that it had moved away from it, then it tends to develop, it tends to become, you know, to build a civilization. And then when it moves back to Islam, it tends to go backwards because it seems to reduce intelligence, but it also becomes more ethnocentric. So that was really, really what I looked at. I think it's a very interesting thing. And so all I was arguing in the book was that if we can learn from Muslims, I'm not saying we should become Muslims. I'm not saying, as people have some twats on Twitter have tried to tweet, that we should become Muslims. Although there is a secondary historical source that suggested that King John was so desperate and bankrupt at one point that he begged the Emir of Morocco. He said, "Bail me out, and I'll make England Muslim." So it could have happened. But probably it's apocryphal though. But certainly we can learn. They are doing something right, which is the way in which their society elevates ethnocentrism. And the other thing that's interesting is that when you look at the decline of Islamic society from the sort of 1000s onwards, it's exactly the same as now. The parallels are unbelievable. You have immigration into the cities, into Baghdad. You have female empowerment in Baghdad. You had women becoming lawyers and women becoming notaries and women becoming judges and all this sort of thing. All of these signs you had sexual license and all this stuff, all of these signs of a declining civilization are the same. And when Islam is, when they react against that and they become more Islamic and they therefore become more ethnocentric, more group selected and less decadent, that's when they're on the rise. And but also, of course, the intelligence seems to go down a bit. But that's more than
I have a couple of questions about this.
Yes.
Now, obviously, I've written a book as well. It's probably not what's classed as an academic work in the same way that yours would be classed as academic works. I believe that you don't class me as an academic, Edward. But what I will have to say is, would you suggest that some of the successes of Islam aren't specifically successes of Islam? They're successes of a society that essentially manages to keep the family unit together, has a strong father figure in the home, has a strong disciplinarian in the home, which is usually the father figure. And this brings children up in a structured family-based environment where they have discipline, where they have order, where they have a strong alpha role model. And one thing that we've lost, because you see, we used to have a family structure like that. And I'm not suggesting, you see, I've heard people say, oh, Islam does all these good things, so maybe we should adopt Islam. And I don't believe that.
I don't think that would. I mean, to answer your question, I don't know. We shouldn't. You can't expect us to adopt Islam. We have co-evolved with Christianity. So we have been under very harsh Darwinian selection since the last collapse of civilization around about in the Dark Ages. Since about 1100, we were under harsh Darwinian selection. There's evidence since then that we were becoming more intelligent because we were under harsh Darwinian selection and it was selecting for intelligence because intelligent people were became rich. And if you were rich, you could provide better resources for your kids and therefore you'd be more likely to pass on your genes. So we were under this harsh selection for intelligence, but we were also under selection for religiousness. We know that. Religiousness is about 0.4 heritable. It's associated with fertility. It's associated with mental health, physical health, whatever. So we're under selection for religiousness. And we have co-evolved with this specific kind of religiousness, with Christianity. And there are these people on the right, or whatever you want to say, on the traditionalist right, such as René Guénon, who adopted Islam, who argued, oh, you know, we should just basically literally become Muslims. I don't see that as happening because it's alien to us. I don't think it's alien. It's culturally alien. It's evolutionarily alien in a lot of ways. So I would agree with you that what these religions do that, or rather what the religion does is it takes that which is adaptive in an evolutionary sense, and it makes that into the will of God or the gods. And therefore, it's more likely to be followed because you don't follow it, you go to hell. And therefore, religiousness becomes a marker that you are loyal and cooperative and you're a person that can be done business with in the group and you can be trusted. It's like insurance policy. And therefore, those that don't have the religion are removed and are persecuted. And therefore, the society dominates other groups in the battle of group selection. And as you say, patriarchy is central to this because when you have a group... ethnocentrism, which is under computer models, positive ethnocentrism, making sacrifices for your groups, cooperating with your group, basically, and negative ethnocentrism, repelling the outsider. That's what wins. That's what dominates the battle in computer models. How do you get men to cooperate? How do you get men to cooperate and not fight all the time? They have to be sure that they're not being cuckolded. How can they be sure they're not being cuckolded? They have to be able to control the women. So it's the women that... There's a very interesting paper on this by these two women called Grant and Montrose in Mankind Quarterly. Women created patriarchy because women are selected to want the man to invest in them. They select for status and power and wealth. The man just selects for beauty and youth and wants to just pump and dump and just, you know, just to have sex with as many fit young birds as he can get away with. That's the man's strategy because he has nothing to lose. The woman can get pregnant. She has something to lose. She wants investment from the man. The man invests, therefore he wants to be sure his investment's not going to waste. How can he be sure of that? He has to control the woman. How can he control the woman? Through a situation of patriarchy, which then reduces into male conflict and allows a complex society to be built up. And that's where these things like purdah and female genital mutilation and all of these aspects, even witch burning, that's where they all come from. it's a means of controlling females, because the more patriarchal society is the more ethnocentric society, the more the religion promotes the patriarchy, that's then the more ethnocentric, the more dominant society, and that dominates. So yes, patriarchy is... I'm doing a book on this at the moment. It's not published yet. It's called Witches, Feminism and the Fall of the West. I'm just writing it now on patriarchy. Yeah, absolutely, that's true. But the thing is that it's Islam that is at the moment doing this and doing it successfully, and Christianity is cucked. So we have to... The only branch of it that perhaps isn't is, and I mentioned this in my book, in the Islam book, is orthodoxy. So if there was to be a revival of Christianity, and I think there'd have to be, then I think orthodoxy might be where it would take place.
So really, it isn't actually Islam that's having a positive effect. It's the patriarchy. And it's the fact that they hold themselves together as a family group. And Islam is actually a mechanism that holds them together. But if we had a mechanism to hold our people together, and our mechanism for holding our people together has been broken down, we have seen the sort of legalization of wholesale divorce. We've seen the destruction of Christianity. And on top of that, I think one of the most damaging things, and I wrote about this extensively in my book, has been soap operas, because soap operas are so popular. They are so pervasive. You're surrounded by them. There's so many of them, but all of them have one central theme, and that is that families are dysfunctional. Every family in a soap opera is dysfunctional. Every father is cheating on his wife. Every mother is fancying the milkman. They're all up to no good. And people who watch these things, I was actually discussing this on a show that I did in Australia yesterday morning, and I was saying that the problem is many people who view fantasy view it as reality or as a slice of reality or a reflection of reality. So when they constantly see families battling, when they constantly see husbands and wives cheating on each other, they see that as something that is natural and normal and act it out in their own lives. Whereas in Islamic countries, they are very, very strict on what they allow people to watch, and they don't have the same media that we have. They're not watching Coronation Street. They're not watching EastEnders. They're not watching Hollyoaks. And when you look at modern television, there isn't a single soap opera or family-based show today where everybody gets on, where the children are respectful to their parents, where the wife is loving and wants to stay at home, where the father goes out to work, and where they all get on and no one cheats on each other. In fact, it's quite the opposite. And the storylines in these soaps that gather the most viewers are obviously the most salacious, the ones with the most infidelity or the worst things going on. And people then begin to imitate that. And I believe this is all part of a plot against Western people. I believe that the destruction of the church, the removal of morality, the legalization of divorce, the pushing of these terrible soap operas, and this idea that we're all secretly out to be unfaithful to our partners, that our children shouldn't respect us. I think all of that, it's all happening at exactly the same time.
Yes,
I think the same people are behind it.
Well, it's very interesting that there was a watershed in probably in the 60s, and Philip in Britain anyway, and Philip Larkin articulated it as being 1963. You know the poem, "Sex came rather late for me in 1963, somewhere between the end of the Shatterley Band and the Beatles' first LP," and I think that's probably the case. There's this research that indicates that once 20% or 25% of a population are questioning the current dispensation, then people start to defect to the questioners, and the whole dispensation can collapse, and it can collapse very quickly. And it seems that that's kind of what happened. And there's research indicating that in the 1960s, there was no relation. Autism predicts being an atheist. People that are autistic are less likely to believe in God. Research data from the 1960s indicates that there was no relationship between paternal age, which predicts autism. Men that are old when they have kids are more likely to have autistic sons. There was no relationship between mutant semen. There was no relationship between paternal age and atheism in people born in the 30s. In people born in the 60s, there is that relationship. So what's happening is that those that were born in the 30s, the cultural pressure to conform to religiosity was so strong that even if they were autistic and therefore or naturally didn't believe in God, they still kind of forced themselves through what Kevin MacDonald calls effortful control to do so. But they had broken down sufficiently that 30 years later, they didn't do so. And so that shows you that this thing had broken down. And what I put it down to is what my colleague, Michael, call spiteful mutants. So that you're under, as Darwinian selection breaks down, you get more and more of these people who have maladaptive ideas because the gene pool is getting large and all of these negative mutant genes that are associated with bad health don't get washed out anymore through 50% child mortality. they rise to positions of power, and they have these maladaptive death wish kind of ideas like multiculturalism, feminism, whatever. And then eventually they start to influence even non-carriers to espouse these and to carry out these views and to limit their fertility and leave having kids till too late and whatever. And they influence the media. And as you say, you get them in, you get soap operas. I think with the BBC, even if you go back 30 years to when we were kids, Mark, there was something a lot more wholesome about a lot of the output. That not every bloody character in Coronation Street was divorced. Not every character in EastEnders was having an affair. And not everything was based around this. And there was a lot of things that were just about like Darling Buds of May, things like this. Of course, that was written in the 50s. They don't get divorced, they don't have affairs.
And yeah, but one thing I'll say, I just want to interject there.
Yeah.
Even from Coronation Street's inception, you actually saw them breaking taboos, doing things or publicizing things on television that had never been published before, never been shown. They were the first, I believe Coronation Street was the first show to show an extramarital kiss. Now, although when you go 30 years back, you might see a more watered down show or something you think was more wholesome, at the time, a lot of people looked at that programming and were like, oh my gosh, they're showing somebody cheating on television. And I think a lot of this has been a slippery slope. Today we are like, oh my gosh, Hollyoaks is showing sort of these teenagers doing absolutely terrible things. And we're shocked by that. But in the future, people might look back and go, well, Hollyoaks was pretty tame in 2020, but look what they're pushing now. And there has been, it's the same in movies. I mean, if you look at a very controversial movie when it was released, Rebel Without a Cause, and you watch that today, you would think it was positively tame. Whereas when you look at what pushes as controversial now, we've gone so much further down that road.
That's true. I was watching they had on TV a few hours ago here in Finland this program. I don't know. It's because it's called Two and a Half Men. I can't remember what it's called. It's about these two brothers that live together. It's a very bad American comedy. And they have this little chubby boy.
Yeah, it's Two and a Half Men. It used to have Charlie Sheen, but then it had some other guy who.
Right, this is it. Two and a Half Men. Okay, this was on. And they were talking about sex. And my daughter said to me, Daddy, why are they talking about sex when the Ikaraya, the age border, is 7? So why are they talking about, why should a 7-year-old be, why would they talk about sex when 7-year-olds are allowed to watch this? And I said, yeah, because when I was a child, that would have probably been rated 12 or maybe even 15, and it wouldn't have been on until after 9 o'clock. So, yes, it's a very good point that you make about that. It's quite right. There's been this gradual, we've been gradually inured, is that the word, to all of these things, such that we're kind of unshockable now. So you have to, yeah. So, yeah, that's true. So as I said, since the 60s particularly, that's when there was, I think, the break. Reality, as it was shown on TV, was, I think, perhaps unrepresentative of what reality was like. I mean, people in real life did swear and they did have affairs, but of course, far more rarely than is now portrayed in things like Coronation Street or whatever these days. But at least it was realistic with regard to what people talked about with regard to race and whatever. And now it's shifted the other way, and you people on TV don't talk about race. Race doesn't exist, but sex is all they think about. And that's an interesting point. With the decline of civilizations, there was a guy called J.D. Unwin. In the 30s, 1934, Sex and Civilization. And he noted that as a society rises up, it represses sex more. And then as it declines, it stops repressing sex. Because if it stops repressing sex, then it stops. That's a sign that the religiousness is declining, the ethnocentrism is declining, and so the society is falling apart. So it's the rise of sex, I'm afraid, is the marker of the end.
Well, thank you for saying that. I just want to say to people, I don't often push my book on this show, but my book is free, The Fall of Western Man, and you can find that on my website, www.thefallofwesternman.com. And in that book, I give examples of exactly what we're talking about, and I specifically compare two films which have exactly the same sort of moral framework, and one is Rebel Without a Cause, and the other is a film called Kids. Now, both of those films were made at very different times, but they both have the same underlying message: rebellion, children acting up, young people pushing boundaries. But you can see that what was once very controversial is now absolutely passé. And what is now controversial is far, far further down the road of unacceptability, to the point where if somebody had tried to make the film Kids in the 1960s or 70s, there'd have probably been riots. But now it's acceptable.
But similarly, when you look at the development of civilization, a lot of the things that were in Chaucer or Shakespeare became increasingly less acceptable as the civilization developed, as we became more intelligent, higher in conscientiousness, and higher in the, as we selected for these psychological profile that's associated with higher civilization. And by the Victorian era, you have people trying to justify it, saying, oh, Shakespeare's a genius and he only wrote these things about sex and whatever in his plays to appeal to the standlings, to appeal to the people in the Globe Theatre that couldn't afford a seat because they were the lower sort, the equivalent of the working class in Elizabethan England and Chaucer. And you even get cases of them censoring Shakespeare and censoring Chaucer because as the society reaches its peak of high intelligence and high religiousness and high sort of repression, basically, of these things, then it represses sex more and more. And now, of course, people love the sexual elements to Shakespeare. They play those up. They think this is fantastic stuff. So that's another example of the change.
Wow.
We you have anything to add, Jason? Go for it, my friend.
Yeah. I mean, we have covered a lot of ground here, right? Just getting started. We're talking about intelligence and economy, religion, and propaganda on our televisions, entertainment, etc., immutable characteristics, and I believe probably physical causes. And this is what I want to put to Ed here in just one moment. But I first thing I want to say is, when it comes to entertainment, we perceive entertainment by way of our subconscious minds. And that is that we are not actively using our conscious minds and remembering the entirety of the time that we are imbibing the entertainment, that it is simply entertainment. You just try to laugh at a scene where a man is beating up a woman on a television and see what the people in the room think about you. They're going to be horrified. Listen to the words that they use when they talk about the actors in the stories. They'll say he did this because he was upset or he had been lied to or something. And then you interrupt them and say, no, he did that because it's in the script. And you watch the looks on their faces contort as they try to gather how that exactly is clashing in their minds. And then what ends up happening, and then also, I mean, you could look at when you're watching the entertainment. So it's not just some element of us. It's the entirety of us. Entertainment becomes who we are. It becomes what we perceive the world to be. There are very few of us that use our conscious minds to interrupt that process. And you can try to interrupt that process with others and see how upset they become. You can say things like, well, people can't actually fly. Say that in the middle of a movie. Say that in the middle of a movie that, well, a 120-pound woman can't actually throw a 200-pound man in combat, and see what the person says to you. They get very upset by this because it is a part of them, the subconscious mind, that is an enormous part that is perceiving the entertainment. That is the part by way that we live our lives by. You primarily live your life by way of the subconscious mind because it takes no energy, happens instantaneously. When you learned how to ride a bicycle, you had to consciously put effort into learning and riding the bicycle. It was cumbersome, it was difficult, but once this was learned, it was passed into rote memory, subconscious mind, and you're able to do other things while riding the bicycle. Just the same thing with driving your automobile. And when you watch entertainment, and we talked about this before on my channel plenty of times, you see the horror movie where the monster's in the woods, and then for some reason, when you walk by the woods near your house, you have nervous feelings, as though the monster in that movie was real, as though you somehow, it has stuck with you. Those same feelings, that same nervousness that you had when you were watching the horror movie about something completely fiction, that same nervousness, the same sweat, the same pulse racing, you then get about the woods that are near your house that have no monsters in it, no evidence in it whatsoever, but that is what you're living your life by.
I was in the Bronx in New York some years ago, and I had this overwhelming desire to shoot up some people. and I realized it's because I've been playing Grand Theft Auto at my friend's house. So realistic that it looked like the Bronx, that it had primed me to want to shoot up some bitches and hoes and that.
Yeah.
I know what you're talking about the unconscious mind. That is entirely true. I want to respond, if I may, to a remark in the chat, which was that even the Romans censored, and they censored Ovid. Yeah, but the point is, at what point in the cycle of Rome, at what point were they doing that? When? Because that's the thing that you find in Rome and in Greece, which is that they reach a high point where they're very, very conservative and whatever, and then they start to become less conservative. And towards the end, before towards there were other sub-cycles within Rome, but then towards other periods of Rome, they were very open, both at the beginning and at the end, to sort of sexual, before Christianity, I mean, to sort of sexual license and whatever. So there's this it's a cycle of civilization, and we are in a period towards the end, the winter of civilization, really, and that's when patriarchy breaks down. It's when sexual repression breaks down. It's when female rights manifest very strongly. It's when you get immigration into the large cities of the empire, and that's the point. And you had that in Rome, but yeah, subconscious mind with Grand Theft Auto is a big problem. I don't know if you've ever experienced.
You might have to talk to your therapist about that. If that continues, you might have to definitely talk to your therapist. But I do have the question about the intelligence, and I wonder if I might put to you, because intelligence, as I have read over the years, and the White Positive Sphere, they've focused some folks just the entirety of their careers on IQ data. And I'm wondering how, I'll put this question to you in two part. First of all, I wonder, are there physical traits of the Arab race, or the variety of Arab race, that could be influencing this as well as thought, or in the place of thought, that is causing IQ to be drawn back for a time? Maybe this, the age range you were giving there was perhaps this, puberty. Is there something about that in their race? Has there been any studies that would perhaps play this deleterious role?
If you're talking, that's true. I don't think it's just a matter of the school system. I think it's two things. One is the school system is bad, and therefore they don't reach their phenotypic IQ limit, the maximum possible IQ that they could get. That's the first thing. And then the society itself is less intellectually stimulating than ours, and so they don't think in a scientific way all the time like we do. We have to analyze and things all the time, and so therefore they don't reach their maximum average IQ. I think the second thing is, yes, it's what you call life history strategy, and that is that if you are evolved to an environment which is unstable and plentiful, basically you live fast, die young, then there's the basic needs are met, and so the selection for intelligence is more limited because there are fewer cognitive problems to solve, and so people in those ecologies don't tend to be as intelligent. If you're evolved to a kind of ecology we're evolved to, which is very, very, very cold compared to the Arab world, and it's very, very stable, clear seasons, not massive outbreaks all the time, things like this, so it's harsh and stable, then there's more cognitive problems to solve, and so this selects in favor more of intelligence, and also it selects more of slowing down. If you're in that kind of ecology, you can't just live fast and die young and just have sex with lots of women and hope some children survive, because in a cold ecology, they'll all die. If not invested in, they'll all die. And so you start moving energy away from sex and towards nurture, towards investing in your female and investing in your offspring. And therefore, life starts to slow down. If you have a long childhood, you have more to learn in this predictable ecology. So you learn about it, you're more likely to survive. So you're in an arms race against other members of your own species or your own group. And you have to get knowledge and you have to learn about the environment and whatever. And so therefore, everything slows down. And so what you get at the extremes is a situation where if you compare black children at the age of about 3 to Japanese children, the Japanese children are more intelligent. The Japanese children are better at solving cognitive problems. And eventually the Japanese children will take over because they operate a slower life history strategy. And this is in every level it's seen. I'm doing a book about this at the moment, in every level, in puberty, what age you go through puberty, even how long the gestation is, everything. And so what would be likely is that the life history strategy of Arabs is a bit faster than ours. And consequently, they would be more intelligent, younger, they would peak sooner. And then Europeans who have a slower life history strategy would, well, they're already ahead of them, but would overtake them more. So, yeah, so I think that's relevant.
Can we say then that it's entirely possible that it is a genetic, not necessarily predisposition, but cause to the what they then end up creating as a religion that nurtures that genetic predisposition, that they are coming into some sort of period where, given their environment, they are, the brain is shutting down to some degree so that they can just quickly get out there and have as many children as possible. And then they create a doctrine that then says that is holy. That's the
well, it's slightly, yes, I mean, that's true, but it's slightly different from that. It's the group that survives and is selected for and doesn't die out will develop a doctrine that renders holy that which is optimally adaptive for that group in that place. So that's what Islam has done. And so you could, and so you would think Christianity is not something that's the same everywhere. You get Christianities that reflect a faster life history strategy, perhaps, and Christianities that reflect a slower life history strategy. The point is that the group, the successful group will adopt the strategy which is optimal for them in order to optimally pass on their genes and survive in that ecology and in the battle with other groups. But in that sense, yes, you're right. You could argue that the religion will sanctify at any given point a certain life history strategy. And if the life history strategy speeds, if the environment changes, and in order to survive, you need to slow down or speed up, then the group that survives will have adopted a religion which sanctifies that. And so in that sense, you're right. Yeah, an element of it is definitely simply to do with environment. We know that because we can compare changes in one country across time in their policies on Islam and how this alters the IQ of the children over time. So that's, but yeah, I think your element of it is genetic, a genetic difference, yes.
This is final part of the question. And this is also vis-a-vis the competitor groups, because we don't know exactly if, for example, let's say that Western kind was the antithesis of what we have become, this pathetic, unheroic, matriarchal society. Islam, or I guess we would have to even break it down into its individual factions and the individual groups of Arabs that may be, you know, more one way than another. But Islam then, in its contact with Western kind and or whatever part of Western kind you want to say, and whatever Christianity, you also said that we evolved with Christianity, and I wanted to ask about, aren't we also influencing Christianity, putting our stamp on it, based on who and what we are genetically? But if this dynamic between the Arabs and Islam might be very different if they were encountering a white race that was antithetical. So it's also their physical environment, as in the temperature, rain seasons, and all of this sort of thing, but also the other groups that they come into contact with. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. That's very important. So it's the level of group selection. So if they come up against a group selection, it can be reduced down basically to, if you're high in positive and negative ethnocentrism. So if you come across a group that is high in positive and negative ethnocentrism, higher than you are, then it will destroy you. All else being equal, I mean, there are other factors that are relevant, also intelligence and the ability to create complex weaponry, and there are other factors as well. But all else, that's the sort of key thing, ethnocentrism. So therefore, there's a battle of different groups. As the Islamic group, in, let's say, the time of the Crusades, came across a European group that was extremely high in ethnocentrism, positive negative ethnocentrism, therefore extremely religious, and they weren't. They were at a later stage of their civilization, where high civilization had been reached, leading to slight reasonable sort of medicine to a certain extent, and certainly to a situation, I suspect, where intelligent people, because they had a certain degree of luxury, stopped having children. And that's what you always seem to see in societies that get to a certain level. Highly intelligent people seem to stop wanting to have children, and then they start questioning things. They start questioning the religion. The religiousness starts to kind of break down. People become less religious, and the society becomes less ethnocentric. That's what they got to by the 1000s. Whereas we were the opposite. We'd been like that, and now we were extremely ethnocentric, and that's why we managed to outdo them. And then subsequently, of course, now this situation has reversed. So yes, a big part of it is group selection. Two groups together, you're going to get an arms race for ethnocentrism, and probably also an arms race for genius. And I look at that in my book, At Our Wit's End, Why We're Becoming Less Intelligent and What It Means for the Future. We used to produce more per capita geniuses, because geniuses are relevant to select, to group selection, because the genius comes up with an invention, it benefits his group, and the group expands. And we've got fewer geniuses because we've got less group selection, because there's less, we're just not really at war like we used to be all the damn time.
And this, I guess, might be a, just for the fun academic sort of a point. But if we were antithetical to the way we are today, then potentially, and we were quite hostile toward Arabs that were very ethnocentric, then potentially over time, a passive Islam could end up being, come to more to being, because we would then be waging war, waging conflict with those who are more aggressive. The passive ones then would be the ones that would be reproducing. So we would essentially, by being more aggressive, engender a more passive Islam and a more passive Arab race.
Well, on the other hand, they'd fight back. Mm-hmm. So they'd kill our most aggressive people. And so then you'd get other factors that would become relevant as well, I think, particularly intelligence. That would then start to become extremely relevant. And that's what happened. In the past, if you go back to the 19th century or whatever, it seems to me, I look at this in a book of mine called Race Differences in Ethnocentrism, we seem to be congenitally less ethnocentric than other races. Mm-hmm. But as long as the ethnocentrism doesn't drop below a certain level, that doesn't matter, and because the religiousness upholds it, because we're stressed and there's mortality salience and we're religious, then we're so much more intelligent. And we produce, most importantly, we produce these geniuses, these amazing outlier, mega clever people. And so consequently, it doesn't matter that we're less ethnocentric. We still dominate them. So these kinds of factors would also come into play. But yeah, the point is with group selection conditions where groups are battling for resources. And if you don't win that battle, your group dies out. That's how it used to be. Your group literally dies out. Then that will select in favor of ethnocentrism, and it will select in favor of intelligence and genius, and you will get this arms race that occurs. And it's been suggested in At Our Wit's End that's one of the reasons why we became cleverer and cleverer and cleverer, because we were constantly fighting within Europe and fighting each other and whatever, and the group that was more intelligent would beat the other group, and therefore it pushed up intelligence, pushed up genius, pushed up civilization.
Do you see the elements of this knowledge, of this understanding, being applied to Western kind by anti-white elites in order to make us a more passive and matriarchal people?
I don't know the extent to which they're kind of a religion. And so they feel like religious people, they feel a strong sense that they're an anti-religion. I mean, they're a religion of most religions are normally under Darwinian conditions. The idea is to promote your people and make adaptive things the will of God. Theirs is the opposite. It's to make maladaptive things the will of not so much God, but of sort of moral, sort of reified morals, such as equality or whatever, these kind of things that they worship, kind of almost like reified nouns. And so it's an anti-religion, it's a death cult. And being a death cult, they have a strong sense of disgust against those that they see as heretics or those that they see as of a different religion. And therefore, I think perhaps they probably couldn't bring themselves to read this kind of research, and they try and get it removed from academic journals if it gets through peer review. They say it's been a failure of peer review, rather than that science is amoral and something that's as it were hate truth has got through peer review, and that's just the way it is. And so I find it hard to believe they would. Maybe they do read it so they can condemn it. I mean, I had to peer review this article today for an academic journal, and it was such a load of twaddle. It was such nonsense. Just so bad. And I forced myself to slog through these bad arguments because I told the editor of the journal I would, and I didn't want to let him down. I've been an editor of an academic journal. I know what it's like if they take ages, you know. So I read it, you know. And so perhaps there's that element. Perhaps they will do it in that way. You know, they want to write a critique of it. So they want to write a critique pulling J. Philippe Rushton's Race, Evolution, and Behavior apart. So they've got to kind of read some of it. So in that sense, yes, they're aware of it. They understand it. You may be right if you're very, very cynical about it, that they understand these things. But I don't think it's so much a conscious thing. I don't think it's like a conscious that some people perhaps,
right?
Not for a lot of European people. I think they're just maladaptive people that they're mutants. They have mutant genes which would have been purged under normal Darwinian conditions. The socioeconomic state is about 0.7 heritable. It's highly genetic. The upper class have been under Darwinian selection for less time, consequently, than the lower class. They're therefore, because Darwinian selection, industrial revolution, it broke down. Darwinian selection broke down first among richer people because they have better conditions and whatever. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you're more likely to have these mutant-type people with these, because these mutant ideas, because the health, the physical body correlates, the physical health correlates with the mental health, and the brain is 84% of the genome. So they're right, as I've discussed before on here. And so consequently, and they just have an instinct, essentially, to destroy their own people. It's an instinct that would be purged under normal Darwinian conditions. But we're not under those. We have 1% child mortality. I mean, until 1800, 90% of people that were born didn't breed.
Wow. And
50% child mortality, 20% don't marry, 20% witness all their kids die before them. So 90% of people, and there have been studies that have shown that for any species to remain genetically healthy, 90% of those born must not breed. And we are now in a situation where something like 80% of people do breed.
Oh, yes.
And child mortality is 1%. And so obviously we're going to be a very different people from the people that we used to be when we were at the height of Industrial Revolution, when we had the 1870, we had the highest level of per capita genius in our history. As I said at Mark's conference, those of us like ourselves, we are the sort of 10% of people that would have survived under these harsh Darwinian conditions. Mm.
Okay, well, that has been very, very, very thought-provoking and interesting, but we haven't got to any of the news items. Now, we are going to speak about the horrific case of Emily Jones. We have had super chats about that, so we'll save that for the super chats. But before we get to this, and I want Ed's opinion on this and Jason's. I don't want this to take half an hour, though, because we've got a lot of super chats, but it does need discussing. Now, I keep getting bombarded with people who want me to speak about 5G and whether I think 5G is some great threat to our people. Now, I want to be very clear. I am not an expert on electromagnetic radiation. I'm not... Edward, you keep hitting your mic. Every time you move, it sounds like you're punching your microphone.
I turned the mic off because you were talking.
Oh, no, but you do something and it keeps sound like you keep tapping your mic. That's all.
Right, I'm turning it off now.
Superb. Well, 5G, I'm not an expert in 5G. I'm not an expert in electromagnetic radiation. Now, I have read reports from people who say this is completely safe. I have also seen a case where something like 180-something scientists have lobbied the EU to suggest that 5G shouldn't be rolled out and that it poses a legitimate threat to our health, to our safety, and to the health and safety of the natural world and our environment. I've seen videos where apparently birds are dropping dead and trees are dying next to 5G masts. Now, I will say this, and this is going to annoy people, so prepare to see the view count drop. But every time I see a video of birds allegedly falling from the trees, the videos are taken in portrait mode. The person looks like he's got some form of neurological disease where he can't hold his camera steady. There is no context. There's no, oh, well, I'm here on this particular street in Leeds. They have just installed a 5G mast there. Look at my wide-angled landscape shot showing something else to verify where I am. And here are the pigeons that you regularly see dropping dead. A guy driving down a street in the middle of nowhere and some dead birds is not... is not evidence. That's evidence to people who want to believe something. That's evidence to people who have some form of bias and are looking for anything to grasp onto to prove their point. And I put those videos in the same category as that idiotic video that had been edited to make it look like a terrorist who had been shot dead actually got up. And when you analyze the videos, you could see there was so many discrepancies, it clearly wasn't what people were making it out to be. But people want to believe that kind of thing. So then they argue that it absolutely is what they say. So I'm not saying 5G doesn't harm us. I'm not saying 5G does harm us. But I am saying that it would be very sensible, if there are concerns, that we basically as a people, or as a group, or as a political movement, should be open to people's concerns. And we should certainly talk about proper testing for 5G. Now, where I draw the line is, I think some people are getting a little bit of the crazies. They've been locked in during this lockdown. And now I'm hearing that viruses don't exist. Viruses are made up. The coronavirus is some mega hoax. It's all crisis actors. And anyone that's been affected isn't actually affected via coronavirus. They're affected by 5G. And coronavirus is a cover-up because 5G is making people ill, so they have to blame something. Oh, my gosh. And then people saying, somebody in the chat, you are so close. You are so close to getting your comment removed. Watch David Icke on 5G. I don't want to watch David Icke on 5G. Everyone sends me David Icke videos. They find it hilarious. I watch them. I've watched the one where he claims Saturn is Satan's broadcasting station. I've watched the one where he claims the moon is hollow. I've watched the one where he claims that the queen is actually a lizard person. I've watched the one where he claims a certain Middle Eastern tribe aren't doing it, but they're being affected by the lizard people too, that definitely exist. And I thought the lizard people was a euphemism for the tribe from the Middle East, but it's not. He thinks there's lizard people. The fact is, okay, I am so not bothered with what that man says. I don't dislike him. I don't hate him. I don't want to do him any ill. I think he's a harmless, pleasant chap, and he might be a lot of fun to have a beer for if he ever comes to my neck of the woods and wants to come for a barbecue with me and Sophia. He's welcome to. He's an interesting guy, but I can't take him seriously. I can't take him seriously because he at one point claimed that wearing turquoise tracksuits gave you some sort of superpower. This is nonsense, you know. And what I'm saying is 5G is a legitimate concern. I don't understand all the science. I don't understand all the science. But the fact of the matter is it may pose us health threats. So might a lot of other things. So might high-frequency electricity. So might using mobile phones. So might standing too close to the refrigerator. I don't know. Lots of people have lots of different theories. But the fact is, if we as a community and a movement double down on 5G is going to kill us all, then it doesn't. We're going to look very silly. So I suggest we actually be very measured in what we say. Now, when we say that we are going to become a minority, we know that's true. There are actual facts. You can see it happening. But I remember, and I'm going to give you a little history lesson here. Back in the days of the BNP, there was a big thing at the time, a big worry. And the big worry was called peak oil. And the idea of peak oil was that the world was going to get to the point very, very, very soon where it was going to get radically more expensive to extract oil from the ground. And all of a sudden, oil prices were going to shoot up. So the only people that could use air travel, the only people who could run a car, were the super, super rich. And essentially, oil-based economies were going to crash, and it was going to be Mad Max, the Road Warrior. Ed Dutton was going to be the humongous. I was going to be stood at his side, and we were going to be saying, hand over the gasoline, and we will give you free passage through the wasteland. It didn't happen. But Voice of Freedom, our newspaper, had that as a front-page article. We pushed it heavily. People were talking about it. This was a massive buzz. Yet here today, oil prices have actually fallen in many countries. And certain countries in South America have such an oil surplus, they can't actually get rid of it. And their economies are crashing because they're based on a resource that we now have tons of. So there have been lots of things that have been suggested that, you know, somebody else is in the chat, the millennium bug. Remember when the millennium bug was going to destroy us all? I just am saying that we need to be careful in what we say. And turning around and claiming that something's going to wipe out all life on the planet might end up leaving us with egg on our face when in 10 years down the line, the same people are saying 6G is going to kill us. And they've forgotten that 10 years ago, they said 5G was going to kill us. And they were probably the same people who said 4G and 3G were going to kill us. We have to be sensible. But also, trying to connect everything that happens, trying to say that the 5G is connected to the coronavirus and the coronavirus is connected to the lizard people who work for Satan, who lives on Saturn, it all starts to get a bit silly. What are you guys? That's my take. And I'm not being disrespectful to people either. I understand people's concerns. I understand there are powerful groups out to get us. But I'll just make one last point. This is my Columbo moment. And I came to this conclusion today. I was having a shower and I was thinking about this very issue and I came to this conclusion. If 5G was really going to kill us all, if 5G was going to affect us all terribly, okay, and we were all going to be wiped out due to 5G, and 5G is being installed in the most populous areas of our country. So it's being installed in major cities, especially London, the high density areas. It's not being installed in the countryside. It's not being installed on my road because I live in a low density area out in the countryside. Surely the elite, the global elite who all live in these high density areas in London townhouses and very expensive places in Chelsea and all these other lovely areas, and the government lives there, who are all in on this apparently, they'd be the first to have their brains fried, along with the vast majority of the migrant population. If the 5G masks were all today going to kill every single person within a mile radius of them, because that's roughly how far traditional phone masts broadcast from mobile phones, about a mile, you would end up with the only people being alive would be common folk who lived out in the countryside that would be all white. The entire global elite and the vast majority of the immigrant population be wiped out. Now, that isn't what the New World Order wants, is it? So just throwing that out. So, Ed, before we go to the Super Chat, we've got to do in about 10 minutes.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on 5G, viruses, and the New World Order? And
I think it's very good to have a healthy skepticism of government, of the government, and what those in positions of power are telling you will at best need a great deal of nuance, and at worst, at very worst, will be simply untrue, on at least on certain things. But this is, it's possible to take this to an extreme that borders on schizophrenia. And schizophrenia is characterized by you over-empathize and you become you hyper-empathize where autistics under-empathize, and therefore you become obsessed with the feelings of others, and therefore you become paranoid about the feelings of others, because and when a person is a little bit annoyed with you, then you see them as angrily wanting to murder you, and consequently you see evidence of feelings and of people and of emotions behind the scenes everywhere, and you see conspiracy theories everywhere, and some of these conspiracy theories get absolutely ridiculous. There are conspiracies, and there are people that will want to plan to do things to do you in, whether deliberately planned or whether through in a more unconscious way. But I'm afraid to say, and you know, call me an old-fashioned Tory here, but not everything the government says is a lie. If the government tells you if you wash your hands while singing God Save the Queen, then it will remove sufficient bacteria from your hands to make it less likely that you'll contract flu, I suspect that might be true. And so I think, yeah, I there's so many of these things. The Millennium Bug is one, and the conspiracy that COVID-19 is a big lie. And I've had people contacting me. If you don't believe anything at all, you can't live like that. You have to be sensible, use your instincts. Although if you're mad, then your instincts are going to be maladaptive anyway, so who knows. But no, I one thing I noticed with the Islam thing, the Islam book, right, was this paranoia, this basically schizophrenic paranoia. You get this. Schizophrenia is associated with being very, very religious. And it's associated with believing in conspiracy theories and the paranormal. Why? Because they see, they over-empathize. They look for emotions everywhere. They look for intent everywhere and what the intent is, and what, and therefore they become paranoid. And that's why you had someone that said, oh, I said as a joke on our show, Richard Spencer, me and Keith Woods, I said, Muhammad, peace be upon him. And then I said it again, Muhammad, peace be upon him. And someone tweeted, well, for him to say it the first time, perhaps that's a joke, but the second time, he's obviously a Muslim. I mean, for flip's sake. And I think if you're bonkers in the nut enough to think something like that, you're bonkers in the nut enough to get your knickers in a twist over this 5G and over these vaccines and whatever other nonsense I have to hear about. So, no, I'm going to be using 5G, and I'm sure my balls will be fired, and so will yours.
Well, okay. I'm going to get death threats because of this, Ed. You've brought down the 5G fatwa on me for this one, I tell you. So, Jason, what are your thoughts, mate?
Well, I know that there's some research out there about the potential, I think research on mice about 5G and what it does, and does it exacerbate the growth of tumors or something like this. If you are really interested in this and it's really got your attention, but you want to do some good, then make sure when you talk to people and you're helping them to go free, you're trying to spread this message, you say to them, you know what, there should be maybe some more testing on this 5G, because there are some questions out there and they're kind of moving forward with it before everything's been tested. And that's a rational position to take. Don't say that it is causing virus to go wild, or that it's what's making people sick, or all of these speculations. And anybody that has these crazy videos that Mark was talking about, they're not well. Ultimately, Mark, both Ed and Mark are very right. This, they talked about the millennium, they talked about the oil, and they still talk about the oil, by the way. And they talked about the holes in the ozone. Remember, that was going to finish us off. It was all the atmosphere is going to get sucked out into space. Never mind the geomagnetic field around planet Earth, but it was all going to get sucked out into space because of the holes in the ozone. So just, if you're going to use these things, use them in a mature way to say, maybe we need to do a little bit more research and protect the public from dangers that might be out there, instead of putting maybe always the dollar or the pound before people's health and welfare. Do a little bit more research, and people will be grateful for that you would care about their health, the health of their families. But don't make any wild speculations about 5G.
In 2004, they said that there was going to be no ice at the poles by 2020. Yeah. I remember that distinctly, because around it was, and there is ice at the poles. So they were exaggerating and fear mongering, and so it makes you immune to further examples of this.
Yeah,
it does. So the sun, I mean, and this the coronavirus, I think it is obviously very, very serious, though whether it's quite as serious as they're making out. I mean, I've got a speech here, Mark, which I was supposed to be doing in Helsinki, and we were going to meet later this month, and it's not happening. It's cancelled. And not just that's cancelled, but loads of other things. And it's important to get the balance right for people to take this seriously with the creators. If you go too extreme, then people will rebel against it. If you don't do anything, like in Sweden, then you have a death rate that's many-fold higher than in all other countries.
I've just got one last thing to say on this, because we have to get to the super chats. And I don't often do this, but I want to give a massive shout out to Keith Woods on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @KeithWoodsYT. And he tweeted this, and it really was the perfect summary. And this is what we're going to close this section on. He said, "Nationalists, if only a big event would come along that would give us a chance to discredit neoliberalism and globalism and get people to support nationalism and statism, coronavirus happens. Nationalists pretend it's not real, alienate normal people, become libertarians." And I actually agree with him there. the nationalist response to this hasn't been to attempt to capitalize on it, which is what we should be doing. We should be saying that nobody in an island like ours needs to be dying of this, because they could have closed the borders, the airports, they could have tested people coming in. We have, we're in a very unique situation in that people have to come through ports and airports and they weren't tested. And then we could have legitimately said, well, if we've locked it down and it's got here, is it the illegal immigrants? And again, that would be another viable point for us to make. But instead of making these very, very important points, our people are now trying to either pretend it's not happening and that it's all a hoax, or claiming it's 5G. This is for us, the coronavirus. We should be pushing, this should be like pushing it's an open door. So my message to people is, don't be skeptical of things, of course, especially of things like 5G. But when we are gifted with something that is actually living proof of what we have been preaching for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, however long you've been involved in this cause, grasp that with both hands and make hay while the sun shines. You know, this is
the bloody prime minister, is it not the bloody prime minister? The prime minister is in hospital as a consequence of this. So you need no further evidence of the how far it's spread and the seriousness of it. And of course, it's quite true. If the borders were properly policed at an early stage, this would, and there wasn't all this global movement around, this would never have happened. And it's such an obvious argument for nationalism. It's just amazing.
It is, I agree. But there is an obvious argument that we must address, and that is the super chats. We have a stack of super chats and questions. So let's try and get this quick fire done, because there are so many of them and there is only 45 minutes of the show left. Unknown Californian. It doesn't actually say how much money that you actually gave. It's just a little lightning bolt. And it said, please ask Edward Dunking Dutton what size he wears, what size shirt he wears. I want to buy him an Iron Maiden shirt. Where can I send it, Ed? When the wild wind blows, by Maiden rocks up the irons.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I bought an Iron Maiden, my parents bought me an Iron Maiden shirt in Lyme Regis in 1988. But it doesn't fit anymore. But if you want to send me an Iron Maiden shirt, just send one to Edward Dutton, care of the Anthropology Department, University of Oulu, Finland. I don't know. I'm 5'9". I'm probably slightly overweight, I think. Kids will do that to you. So that's about the size. So thank you very much. That would be most kind of you. And I would wear it the next time I'm on Mark's show. I would wear my Iron Maiden shirt.
Excellent. Unknown Californian also gave another super chat, and he said, can the panel define the third position and if they consider themselves a third positionist? Well, I think we can define that quite easily, in that it is neither capitalism or communism. It's a system of productive enterprise where we look after our own people and really put the people, the environment, and genuine productivity above either the social dogma of communism or the out-and-out pursuit of wealth that a capitalist system puts forward. Does anyone else want to try and define the third position very quickly?
No, we can move on.
That's it. Thank you. Marty Morosely gave $5. Thank you very much. And thank you very much to Unknown Californian. I can't read out the amounts because it doesn't show, but Marty Morosely gave $5. Thank you very much. He said, Mark, Ed and Jason, any predictions on what impact Keir Starmer as Labour leader will have on the future of British politics? Was his election to leadership position the worst possible outcome for nationalism? I'll start on this. Obviously, Jason probably won't have too much to say because it's the new Labour Party. He's welcome to comment. But I'll say this. The first thing that Keir Starmer did when being elected to the leadership of the Labour Party was apologise to the Jewish community for apparently failing the Jewish community at the last elections. He didn't apologise to the millions of white working class people that they failed and didn't vote for them again, but he apologized to this minority. And the Times of Israel ran the following headline: after Corbyn, UK Labour elects Keir Starmer, a Zionist with a Jewish wife as leader. New opposition chief immediately apologizes to Jews for anti-Semitism in ranks, vows to tear out this poison. His wife comes from a Jewish family, has relatives in Tel Aviv. I think we know where this is headed. And since this, he's also apparently... The second thing, that the first thing he did was apologize to these people. The second thing he did, which was equally bizarre, was say that his thoughts and prayers were with the Jewish community during the coronavirus. Not his thoughts and prayers were with all of the white working class people that used to vote Labour and now no longer vote Labour, or his thoughts were with the nation, his thoughts were with the Jewish community. I think we know which side Keir Starmer's bread is buttered on. He's a naked Zionist. He's going to pull the Labour Party back to where it was under Tony Blair. He is a Remainer. He is a globalist. And I think everything I've said really explains it. Ed, Jason, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I wasn't happy. I was hoping it would be Rebecca Long Bailey that would be elected, obviously, and failing that, Lisa Nandy, because it would help consign these vicious people to oblivion. And it is slightly concerning that they have elected this person. He's quite photogenic, I'm afraid, and he's experienced, and it's not good news. I suppose you could argue, in terms of positive things for nationalism, it was under the law. It's when you have a Labour government that people tend to turn towards nationalism, as happened last time. We had this appalling Labour government, and that was when there was a rise of nationalism. But there was also incredible damage they did to the country, irrevocable probably damage that they did to the country. So yeah, it's not good news. We need to. On the other hand, the defeat of Labour was so bad that he won't. I doubt he'll be able to win the next election. It's a question of the election after that. And also the popularity of Boris in the land is so substantial. They were commenting at the last. I mean, I think a lot of people would say at the last election, they were commenting, oh, I'm people in Labour, I'm voting for Boris. They wouldn't say I'm voting Conservative, I'm voting for Boris. People like him. And so if they can keep Boris in charge for as long as possible, and he doesn't go the way of Mrs. Thatcher and Tony Blair and other people that are in power a long time and go a bit mad, then perhaps they'll give him two elections, he'll lose, and he'll be dispatched in favour of somebody more ludicrous. But no, I don't think it's a good thing.
Okay, thank you very much. I also say that there might be more on Keir Starmer later, and I might personally produce a video about him and what he was getting up to as head of public prosecutions when he let Jimmy Savile walk away, because apparently there was no evidence. But we'll get back to that
later. Mark, let me just say really quickly, the only thing I think that most people around the world could take from this, even those who are outside of the UK, is that this guy knows exactly where to put his tongue. And that tells you who's in power. He's not licking the boots or other orifices or something of this nature of different groups that have no power. He's telling everybody, this is the group that's in power because this is where I put my tongue. So back to you, brother.
Thank you very much. The Anglo-Saxon teacher gave $20. Thank you very much. She said, no question, just thanks for getting back to me. Well, thank you. And this is really exciting because we are working with this lady and hopefully with another lady. I've sent her an email today about producing a nationalist homeschooling curriculum for the UK. So that's another thing that PA is working on. You see, we're not just about... Some people have tried to smear me and say, I just want to be a political party. We're much bigger than that. A nationalist homeschool network. How does that sound, guys? Celtic Advocate gave £5. Thank you very much. How do I obtain a PA event conference ticket? Sign up on the Patriotic Alternative website. You will receive an email when the tickets are for sale, and then you'll be able to pre-order one. It's as simple as that. And he says, also, how would you say the cultural and demographic situation in the nationalist movement in Britain compares to that of the USA? I think the nationalist movement in Britain is in a far better state. I think the demographic situation in Britain is slightly better. And I think that America has only one advantage, and that is that it's a bigger country. So there's more places for a white minority to run to regroup. The problem in Britain is we might be further away from becoming a minority, but when and if we do become a minority, there'd be less places for us to run and hide because we have a much more densely populated nation. Does anyone have any thoughts on the difference between the UK and the US in terms of its nationalist standing and the demographic issue?
I'll say that I know it seems like in the U.S. we have a lot of places to run and to try to make a political stand. But the power here, since the United States is the superpower of the world, the anti-white elites, they squash everything that as soon as it shows its head. So we might be able to get an office here or there somewhere, very minor, no power whatsoever. Rest assured that when momentum gets rolling, the anti-white elites in this country will move in, and it's both political parties. All you have to do is run a field of what they both want, which is the continuity of agenda that's anti-white, and immediately both parties come after you. The big donors come after you. The NGOs come after you. So the United States is very important to the anti-white elites, and that's what we end up facing.
Well, I've got a question here for Ed. Ed, can you see the private chat here? On the right hand of the pane, the private chat. Maybe you can't because
I'm not hitting the mic. I'm turning it off when I'm not speaking, like you've told me to. And in doing so, I'm hitting the mic.
No, that's not about the. I was just sending you a question. There's a question specifically for you. Ed agree that St. Thomas's Hospital is misspelt by the NHS? They should have another S after the apostrophe. And I've put the spelling in that. Private chat asking to settle a bet. Thank you to Viron, who gave $5 for that question. Is St. Thomas's Hospital misspelled?
Viro often sends me donations for my channel, so I don't want to upset him. But all I can say is that what I was taught at school was that that's spelt correct.
Yeah.
My understanding is that Americans, seemingly, don't they put an S over it after it?
No.
We
have Chicago and New York schools, so there's a little bit of different in the
Chicago
media.
School, you put the S after Chicago school.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because I've published a book recently with a publisher, and their style is Chicago, and mm-hmm. they systematically put the S after, and I didn't like it. It's not what I'm used to. No, I don't know. All I can say is what I was taught when we did this at school. I think we didn't do it till quite late, actually. I always assumed it was apostrophe S. And then I was taught by a student teacher in 1992 called Mrs. Mavity that it was apostrophe on the end and nothing else. And I was like, wow, really? Crikey. And that's now what I do. So I'm afraid that's what I do. Sorry. Okay.
Well, thank you for that. Serena JB gave £3 and says, do you think that the European IQ is dropping due to dysgenic effect? And if it does fall, do you think that the less intelligent Europeans will be more ethnocentric? I think there are dysgenic effects causing IQ to drop. However, I'm not sure whether a low IQ population is more ethnocentric. I think that a low IQ population has many disadvantages, and many low IQ people are more likely to get themselves into trouble, which sees them become, say, debt slaves, or sees them in making poor lifestyle choices, which further deplete our numbers and put us in a worse situation. What do you think, Ed?
Yes, there is very good data on this. I look at it in my book, Adult Wits End, on IQs are going down, and IQs are going down on the more genetic rather than the more environmental components of the IQ battery. And the prevalence of alleles that are associated with very high IQ has gone down among native European peoples over the last three generations. So there's no question IQ is going down, and it's going down because of significantly because of dysgenic breeding patterns. Now the problem is that once you get IQ going down, it creates an amplification effect, because as the people get stupider, then the people that are the teachers get stupider, for example, mm-hmm. and then the schools get worse, and then you don't even reach your phenotypic maximum IQ anymore. So then it goes down for an environmental reason as well as for a genetic reason. But yes, this European IQ, it's been estimated that since between 1880 and the year 2000, we lost about 15 IQ points, which is the difference between, let's say, a policeman and a school teacher, or between a security guard and a policeman.
Okay, thank you very much. We've got another super chat here from Grim Fan. He gave $5. Thank you very much. He said, how do economically inactive, indeed net drains, increase GDP? What am I missing? And I think he is referring to my video last week where I said conservatives bring in migrants to grow GDP. Conservatives do bring in migrants to grow GDP, and some migrants come here and they are a net drain on the economy, but many migrants come here and they work, and even the migrants that are given free money spend that money in the economy. What people don't understand about GDP is it's a measure of the worth of the economy. Now, when the government tax people, they give that money to migrants to spend. And those migrants then spend that money at supermarkets, at shops, on other goods and services within the economy. And one way of growing GDP is essentially by the government spending money or giving out benefits or giving out freebies to people in order for that money to be spent. And when that money is spent, it causes an increase in economic activity. People have this sort of misconception that when migrants come here and they claim benefits, which many do, but many don't. Many of the migrants who come here, especially the ones who come here legally, you've got to remember, legal migration into this country is greater, especially under the Conservatives, than illegal migration. And migrants who come here legally, the migrants that the Conservatives want coming here, are coming here and are actually becoming part of the economic system, and they do this to grow GDP. Now, this has a massively negative effect on regular folk, on the people who are already here and working, because it pushes down wages. But this is all explained in the video I produced last week. I produced a video which has been quite contentious, especially for people who are capitalists or conservatives, where I pointed out with an analogy that essentially, when you bring in migrants and that grows GDP, the only people that benefits is a tiny minority of people who have the vast proportion of wealth concentrated in their hands. But that's a question for me. So we'll move on quickly. Frodebert Hildebrand gave $15. Thank you very much. Now, this is something we do have to spend 10 minutes on, but this show might overrun tonight because we just have so many super chats. He said, the story of the white 7-year-old little girl Emily Jones getting murdered in broad daylight by a non-white Somalian immigrant makes it very hard not to fed post. I am literally fuming inside. Accounts will be settled. That is all I can say. We shouldn't have to live like this. Keep speaking the truth. This is horrific. There was a 7-year-old girl, Emily Jones. She was out with her family in a park, and she was viciously attacked by someone who had been identified on social media as being a Somalian. Yet this person's identity has been completely covered up by the press, and the police quickly whisked this person away under the Mental Health Act so that their identity isn't being released to anyone. Now, I have heard that the severity of the attack was so shocking, so unbelievably brutal, that the press have again covered that up. I believe the little girl was almost beheaded by the attacker. And as I said, the attacker has been outed on social media as a Somalian, but this is all being covered up. Now, we know what threat these people pose to us. And this story has really shocking parallels with one that I covered a year or so ago. I think it was about a year ago, about a little girl in Leeds who was brutally attacked in a nursery by a Somalian who bit her multiple times on the face. And again, that was all outed on social media, yet the newspapers refused to cover the ethnicity of the attacker. And I think we see two problems here. The first and most obvious, the glaring problem, is the shocking threat that we are faced with thanks to mass immigration. The second thing we are faced with is that this is a conspiracy against us. And if it wasn't a conspiracy against us, the press would be covering this honestly. And let's face it, if a white person, whether it be a man or a woman, attacked a black child and did this, ethnicity would be talked about, but because it's the other way around, it's not. This is a conspiracy. This is being covered up. There is a conspiracy of silence. These people are being brought here, and the people who are bringing them here know what threat they pose us, and that is why they're covering up. This is a shocking story. As a father, this is something that concerns me greatly, obviously. And somebody just put in the chat, the coroner said it was the worst injury he had ever seen. And this is absolutely heartbreaking. One day, I pray that we do come to power. I pray that we achieve our goals. And if that day comes, if we see that day, if I see that day, one of the things that would be, or one of the things that should be our first act, is the memorial for girls like Emily Jones, for all of the people, for all of the Indigenous people who have lost their lives thanks to mass immigration. There needs to be a memorial for this. It's truly heartbreaking. There's not really much more I can say. Ed, do you have any takes on this? Ed or Jason?
Jason appears to have...
No, I'm here.
What could you say? It's just absolutely atrocious and appalling. It's just words fail you. I couldn't believe it when I read that it had happened at all, that a seven-year-old girl would be attacked at all in a park by anybody. Because if the mental health system in our country, in Britain, into which British people pay so much of their taxes, is any good, these people should not be on the streets. It's just outrageous. And then for the person to be Somali and a woman brings in other things, because you'd expect a woman to have more of a sort of a maternal instinct towards children, which of course she obviously lacks. And then that she's Somali, as you say, it's a direct consequence of immigration. These people are victims of immigration. In the same way that in Oulu, where I live, we had all these poor little girls who were groomed and gang raped and whatever by refugees here in Oulu, and one of them killed herself. And they are just victims of immigration. And you can understand why it happens in terms of sort of what I talked about earlier, I'm afraid, sort of, if we put it scientifically, in terms of group selection, that you bond with people according to your degree of genetic similarity to them. And this is true even with friends, are more genetically similar than two random members of the same population. And so this person has nothing. She's very genetically different from these people. Which is another reason why you would expect the level of empathy to be less, even if you controlled for the other factors, such as that she's probably schizophrenic. She might have post-traumatic stress disorder, perhaps. I think 20% or 25% of Somali women seem to, as a consequence of genital mutilation, by the way. So I'm not trying to justify it or whatever, but that's just the fact of the situation. I mean, you could argue that's another reason why you should be careful about letting them into Britain at all. Not that it mitigates it, but that's a reason to be careful of them. So yeah, I think it's absolutely. I don't know how many of these things have to happen for with the rape thing in Oulu. The shock was so incredible, and that hasn't gone away. And this is the kind of thing that with Lee Rigby as well, another one. The shock of that this was done clearly for racial reasons, for reasons of ethnocide, I think. And we need to, you're right, yes. Well, the second thing should be a memorial. Well, the first thing should be dealing with the people that have instigated this situation.
Agreed. Well, look, we're going to have to move on quickly. And Edward, there is a question for you to read out, I believe, in Finnish. It's in the private chat.
Oh, God. Unbelievable.
I'm not reading it, but thank you to the... King Athelstan.
He says Dutton on Victon ethnocentrism in Hera. Dutton is a fucking ethnocentric man. Helvetin multiculturalism is like bloody multiculturalism.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much. F22 Daniel gave $3. Thank you for the donation. And he said monogamy is essential for ethnocentrism because then men are more likely to work together rather than being busy fighting each other over women. What are your thoughts on this? It's a question for Edward. Yes or no might be helpful at this late hour.
Yes.
Agreed. Thank you. Marty Morosley gave $5 and he said, one for Ed. Given the state of Christianity and the unwillingness of many whites to follow it, what new mechanism does he suggest to rebuild a cohesive collective identity that would be conducive to a reordering of European civilizations?
Perhaps some kind of religion based around someone really charismatic like me or Mark or Jason.
Well, that's going to be clipped out. Thank you. Varanasian or Varangian, I can't pronounce your name, my apologies, gave $5. Thank you very much. He said, no question, just books from a jolly heretic fan. Thank you very much. Hal9000 gave £10. Thank you very much. And this is another question for Edward. Dr. Dutton, you're maybe uniquely qualified to answer this. Is Islam the product of peculiarities of the Middle Eastern Arab mind, Or is the Middle Eastern Arab mind a product in part of Islam, etc.? Protestantism, Catholicism, and something I can't pronounce. In other words, are religions actually ethno-religions?
Yes, there is a degree to which what religions are doing is they are. Yeah, that's true. There's the nature of the people is going to be reflected in the nature of the kind of religion they come up with. And equally, the adaptive traits of those people is going to be promoted as the will of God or the gods by the religion itself. So it's a kind of symbiotic relationship, I would say. We've got loads of questions to get through, Mark.
We have got quite a few questions, but you can take your time to answer them.
Yes, on that earlier one, and then there's this woman in the chat saying that I'm actually saying plot twist, S doesn't speak a word of Finnish. I imagine my Finnish accent wasn't good enough for her or something. I could swear.
Take time to answer them. It's just if we run over, I didn't want to keep you longer.
Oh no! I think that's a rough approximation of it. The culture will imbue the religion, and the religion will also have an impact on the culture by pushing it in normally in a more adaptive direction. So that's although under now, of course, with the rise of our clown world, you see that the Church of England is taken over by maladaptive people, and it is literally multiculturalism in a mitre. If you read Justin Welby's latest book, Reimagining Britain, it's just truly appalling. But that's historically what's been the case, yes.
Yeah, Justin Welby is a terrible, terrible human being. JC Starling gave $5 and said, in memory of little Emily Jones in Bolton, the 7-year-old white girl stabbed in the neck and killed by... JC Starling's claiming a Muslim in a British park a few weeks ago. I'm not sure if the person was Muslim. However, I do know, well, I don't know, but it has been heavily commented on social media by people who claim to see it, that the person was Somali. But thank you very much for the super chat.
If the person was Somali, then she was Muslim.
Are Somalians all...
Oh, yeah, I don't think there's hardly any non-Muslims in Somalia.
Apologies to JC Starling. If that is the case, and it is a Somalian and a Muslim, well, this is an awful lot. AltFit gave £5, thank you very much, and said, our UK Marxist overlords have decreed that in 2020 we must elbow bump, self-isolate, and clap every Thursday at 8 p.m., all while the clueless majority are asking for harsh punishments for civil disobedience. They have traded freedom for security. Indeed. F22 Daniel gave $3. Thank you very much, my friend. He says, Mark, how should we perceive the play Othello, given the fact to whom Desdemona was married? I'm going to throw that over to Edward.
Well, Desdemona was married to Othello, and Othello was a Moor. It is the case that in the end doesn't Othello murder Desdemona? I believe that's what happens. Othello murders Desdemona at the end of the play out of jealous rage. So, and I imagine that was tapping into certain stereotypes that were prevalent at the time about ethnic differences.
Okay. The Thin Red Line gave $10 and said, intelligent conversation. Dutty is an English archetype. Edward Dutton is a national treasure. I only wish he was in England rather than Finland so that we could wheel him out more.
You can blame Tony Blair for that. It got so bad, I had an opportunity to leave and I took it. And now I've found myself settled here and used to it.
Yes. Machiavelli Sucks gave $3 and said they try and make private central banking a religion. Indeed, they do. My video this week is about how credit and debt negatively affects both people and an economy. So you might like that. Marty Morosley gave $5 and said, last question for Ed. If those who were previously eliminated under Darwinian conditions are now free and able and possibly encouraged to breed, what is the outcome of this over the long term? Is the breakdown of society therefore inevitable? Thank you for the donation, my friend.
Yes. I mean, if you look at the Mouse Utopia experiment by John Calhoun, you see exactly the same thing. He sets up this utopia for mice, no predation, no disease, control for everything like this. And you see exactly what happened with us. This was in the late 60s at the University of Maryland. First of all, there's a massive spike in population. Then the population growth starts to slow down. Then the population starts to literally fall. And when that happens, what you start to see is these butch, masculinized females who eat their young and chuck their young out of the nest too young and do all kinds of silly things. And then you see the males are increasingly either autistic and maladapted, not interested in sex because they've been chucked out of the nest too young by these messed up mothers, or they're these autistic weirdos who are effeminate and just groom each other all the time and don't try and have territory, and these kind of non-men. And then eventually all of the mice are of these kinds. There's no more mice born, and they all die out. They all die out. But the difference is that we are our own scientist. We are our own Dr. Calhoun, maintaining our own mouse utopia. And so the consequence of that inevitably is that society goes backwards, intelligence goes down, and the society collapses. This is already happening. Intelligence is going down. We can't get Concorde back in the air. It's almost certainly because we're not clever enough to be able to do it. We haven't gone back to the moon since the late 70s. It's probably because we're not clever enough to be able to do it. And there are other things. Right. There was a paper published recently which showed that the number of people that are required to come up with this kind of doubling of technology efficiency every however many years, this kind of idea, Moore's Law, I think it's called, that the efficiency of technology doubles every however many years. The number of people that are required to make that doubling has gone up 16-fold since 1979.
Wow.
Now, so we're getting stupider. We're eating into our capital that we've built up. Eventually, we'll have no capital left and we'll go backwards. So, yeah, I think it's inevitable.
Well, thank you. Jez gave $25. Thank you very much, my friend. He said the first thing Keir Starmer did on becoming Labour leader was apologise to the Jewish community. All mainstream political parties are completely against the native people, and a spiritual and political revival amongst our people through groups like Patriotic Alternative is needed desperately and quickly. Agreed, my friend. And I hope you're doing well during the lockdown. Emperor is Dead gave $5. Sorry about being late to the stream, but did Edward Dutton stop his stream with his buddy?
Who, Michael? No, we do Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time. Always.
Yehuda Finkelstein gave $10 and said, is Starmer Richard Spencer's father? I've got to say, you know that app that called, I think it was called something like Age Me, where you took a picture of yourself and it artificially aged you, so you see what you would look like in 20, 30, 40 years down the line. Keir Starmer does look like a badly aged Richard Spencer, doesn't he? I've got to say, that's funny. Thank you for the super chat, and thank you for the good observation. Unknown Californian gave $10. Thank you very much. And he said, I want to thank the panel for their positivity. Lots of infighting on Twitter gets depressing. You all seem to keep spirits high. Much love. Well, thank you very much. And yes, we do like to bring people together. Above and Beyond gave £8. Question for Ed. What is his theory behind why some women are attracted to weak and dysfunctional men? Why do some make poor decisions with selecting who to provide for them? That is a good question.
Well, I can think of two key reasons. The first would be that those women are themselves maladaptive and have these maladaptive genes which haven't been washed out under Darwinian conditions and under our lack of Darwinian conditions. And consequently, they are, through some weird quirk, evolved to be sexually attracted to people that are maladaptive and that they shouldn't be attracted to. The second thing is perhaps to do with the collapse of patriarchy. So women are... There's a very interesting paper. I did a video on this last week, I think it was, called Menelaos Apostolou, who is a Greek researcher. And he did this paper which he showed that we are evolved to a situation where our parents choose our marriage partners. And that's true to a greater extent for females than for males. Indeed, females are evolved to a situation essentially where other people make decisions for them. And so what you'd expect is for females, particularly once these conditions collapse, once these patriarchal conditions collapse, you'd expect females to be prone, more so even than males, to making bad decisions. And that would include bad decisions about who to marry. And so I think that would also be relevant as well. So I think an element of it is that these women are just as weird as the people they're attracted to. And an element of it would perhaps be a breakdown of optimal environmental conditions.
That's a fascinating answer. Thank you for that. That's very good. Lou Duva gave $3. I'm going to read this one because Lou always makes a donation and they're always wacky questions. But he says, can Professor Edward Dutton of Meany once and for all settle the question of whether there exists race differences in penis size? Also, does Edward know of any environmental means of boosting growth?
With reference to the second question, the environmental means I know of boosting growth is a very pretty lady. And with reference to the first part of the question, I'm afraid the data just isn't good enough. To the extent that we have proper data, it's contradictory, and it's convenient samples such as people with phimosis, and people with phimosis aren't representative of the population at large. Phimosis is when you have too tight a foreskin, so you go to the doctors to have your end off, whatever, you know, your foreskin cut off. And so we just don't have good data on it. There is some indirect data, condom sizes that Rushton talks about, but in his book Race, Evolution, and Behavior, but people have had trouble tracking that down. And then there's an anthropological book which talks about it, which Rushton cites, a French anthropological book. But otherwise, we and that interestingly describes how black men have the biggest penises but the smallest testicles. And that's something that Rushton left out of his book because it didn't really fit with his theory. He didn't, it was made things complicated, but yeah, they apparently. So I do have data on testicles. That we have data on. And I look at it in my book, J for the Rushton Light History Perspective, and that is black people have smaller testicles on average than white people. Now, if they have bigger penis as well, I don't know what's going on there, because a large penis would be that your other men are having sex with the same woman, and so consequently you want to get it as far in as possible to guarantee in a sort of sperm selection thing. But then big balls would be more semen, so produce more semen in a kind of sperm selection thing. So the penis would be a matter of display. I don't know. It's in terms of understanding it, it's just complicated. That's all I can say.
I think we put far too much effort into a troll question, but fun nonetheless. Leachim Olrak gave $20. Thank you very much, my friend. He said, I've no question, just want to make a small donation for your hard work. Thank you. Circus Midget gave $3 and says, Down syndrome people have mild IQ 50 to 69. I think he means to say mild Down syndrome leads to an IQ of, on average, 50 to 69. However, the average Somali is 68. Why would you let people like this in? Very good point. Ask Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer. Street Passer gave $5. Thank you very much. He said, I would argue in the modern world, nationalists draining welfare to produce 10 to 20 or more nationalist genes. Nationalist raised children is justified. I think I see the point that, you know, what he's saying is that we should all go on to welfare and just breed. But I don't think that would make us good role models.
We also, nationalism, I mean, like being right wing, independent of being religious, like controlling for religiosity, being right wing correlates with fertility. And we've got data on this. So we are breeding. The nationalists do breed. The future is not just stupid people. It's religious people and nationalistic people.
Okay. We have one last super chat. We finally got to the end of this. We've done it in time. Novi Honza gave $10 and said, Mark, this is to bless such as little Emily Jones and to damn such beasts as her murderer. Bless you, Dr. Dutton and Jason, heroes. Thank you very much. We've had one last super chat that's just come in. Memophobe gave £5. Thank you very much. It said, keep reporting the vast amounts of multicultural crimes, Mark. They're usually hidden away in local media. Truly shocking when collated. The stories need to be shared and pushed more for the victims. I just want to respond to this quickly. If people see in local papers these anti-white crimes, please contact me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com because I would love an archive of all of these anti-white abuses on the PA website. I'd love the Patriotic Alternative website to have an accurate archive of every single anti-white racist attack so people can go there and see the actual truth of what's happening. And Stephen Ben Bob gave $3. Thank you very much. He said, as a community, I feel we should do something to honour the memory of Emily Jones. I agree. And I said earlier, there should be a memorial in her memory. In fact, maybe we could pay for a memorial and place it in that park. I don't know. The only thing is, I wouldn't want to do something like that and offend her parents in any way, especially not just yet when everything's so fresh and she's probably not even been... buried yet or had.
They can't have a proper funeral, presumably.
No, that's what I mean. So it is something I definitely would like to do, but I think we should. Our parents are going through enough, and we certainly don't want to do anything to add to the problems they're facing at the moment. But thank you for the super chat. We do have questions, and we have time for one, but there is only one top-rated question. Only one question has got more than one like, and it's from Adam. And he said, thoughts on the Jewish Chronicle going into liquidation? So what are your thoughts on the Jewish Chronicle going into liquidation, Ed?
I've no familiarity with the Jewish Chronicle, but I'd rather the Guardian went into liquidation.
What are your thoughts, Jason?
Well, the fact that they have seemingly limitless money in their community, the tiny community that has no power, I would think that they are allowing it to go into liquidation rather than suffering.
Yes, there's another, because the Jewish Chronicle is not the only Jewish newspaper in Britain. I think there's one called Jewish News.
I think the important thing here is that on one hand, we can all have a good chuckle at a load of journalists losing their jobs because, after all, these people are anti-white haters, and they do pour forth with bile about us. But I did enjoy skimming the Jewish Chronicle for articles simply because they were very honest about what they were up to, because I find it's very interesting to read newspapers written by those particular people for those particular people, because they have a very different slant on the news to newspapers written by those people for our people.
That's true. I was reading, there's a woman called Emily Grossman, Dr. Emily Grossman, and she's been on the BBC and things like this, and kind of Adam Rutherford type, but a woman, you know, left wing, sort of that sort of gives into a science enthusiast rather than a scientist, and that kind of person, and therefore it's kind of left wing. Science is science as long as it's woke science. That kind of person. There was an interview with her. I think the Jewish Chronicle, I think it was, in which she goes on and on about how she's a really religious, committed, observant Jew, and that's not something she's ever said in other interviews, but only in the Jewish Chronicle. Or mm-hmm. the Jewish News, whichever it was, and I noticed that there is a degree they're more forthright about
I've got to say this about the tribe, and it's something that my book's actually based on. They have two ways of writing: one way of writing for themselves and information that's meant for their group by their group, and they have another way of writing for us, information that is written by their group for our group to digest. And a perfect example of that is the Freudian model of the mind that has been used by other people in the tribe to undermine our tribe. It wasn't meant for us to read and understand and use for our benefits. And it's the same with the Jewish Chronicle, the Haaretz, the Times of Israel. There's many of these publications that are very, very honest and candid about what these people believe. A great example of this was during the Trump impeachment. All of the papers owned by the tribe, written for the tribe and read by the tribe, were all absolutely rejoicing in claiming that the Trump impeachment was almost a completely tribal undertaking. Yet any of our people that claimed the same thing had their YouTube accounts disabled. True News lost their account over claiming the same thing and literally reading headlines from the tribal press. So we have one last super chat before we wrap things up. Algebra 1AMSU gave $3. Thank you very much, my friend. He says, Mark, have you ever choked on a penalty kick? Chuck Norris tells Jason Cone jokes. Eddie the Head Dutton. Have I ever choked on a penalty kick? Possibly at school, but the most annoying thing is when you're playing PUBG and you get down to the last circle and it's just you and one other person, and you've basically killed your way through 98 other people to get down to the last chance and then fluff it. That is a screen punching rage that can't really be equated to anything other than potentially missing a penalty. But Eddie the Head Dutton and Chuck Norris tells Jason Cone jokes. So there you have it. $3. Thank you very much. So that brings us to the end of the show. And I haven't even had a chance to tell any Sophia stories today, of which I had two very amusing ones. But We'll have to save those for another time. So first of all, as always, Ed, this has been an incredible show. You have been extremely entertaining, extremely knowledgeable. It's been a joy to host you. I hope you will come back again. And I must say, I don't know whether the fans or the viewers or whatever you want to call them, people who watch, will like this or whether they won't. But it's been a very fast-moving show. We've discussed, I think today, an absolute wealth of topics. And it's very rare that we discuss this many topics all in one show. I don't think we've ever had such a fast moving and action packed show like today. So thank you. And I hope people like the different sort of pacing. We've had over 1,500 viewers at our peak. Thank you for making it such a high energy show. But please tell us where we can find your work, how we can contribute.
Thank you for having me. As a different strokes for different folks, as Arnold for different strokes would have put it. So, thank you very much.
No, well, thank you. And please go and support Ed's channel, support him on Twitter and support his work. Ed is a real gem. And I can tell you this, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Ed is the modern day Jonathan Bowden. He is the Jonathan Bowden of the modern British nationalist movement. And I would very much, as PA grows and grows, I want to have him back again for another speech here in Britain. And he is a man that I want heavily involved in the organization because he truly is an example of what makes us as a people so great. Jason, my friend, as always, it's been a pleasure working with you. It's always a pleasure working with you. Please tell us who's on tap, where we can find you, and give yourself a little outro.
Potentially, Lacey Lynn will be on tap this Friday over on my channel, No White Guilt. Please don't miss it. We'll try to do it a little earlier so that folks in the UK can watch. And it's been a magnificent time today. I agree completely. Thank you very much, Ed, for coming on. And it's been splendid appearing with you, brother. I look forward to meeting you in the future. And thank you to everyone out there who's watching live or in replay for all that you do. It's a great honor to me to serve with all of you heroes in service to white well-being. And the only thing I will say that I will leave everybody with is this, that when we have these crimes like on Emily or Landon, who was thrown over the third story railing at the Mall of America by a crazed anti-white, non-white person, is share the phrase hush crime with those you discuss with this, because you automatically win that discussion by doing so. And I pass it back to Mark Collett.
Thank you. We have one final super chat from Wayne Scully, $5. And he says, Mark, what is this about the lizard people? Can you elaborate, please? I'm very interested. Just kidding. God, please don't. Thank you, Wayne. An amusing end to the show. Well, that does bring us to the end. And I would firstly like to say thank you to Ed. You've been magnificent. Thank you to Jason. You're always magnificent. And we'll be back next week with Harry from TRUK. He's a young lad. He has risen to fame thanks to his epic groiping of Daniel Hannum. It's going to be a good show. I've got a video coming out on Friday. Again, it's about GDP, but it's about how credit and debt-based societies that grow GDP through money lending are bad for everyone and also bad for the economy. They place us all in jeopardy and in chains of usury. That's going to be a video that a lot of nationalists really like, so please check it out on Friday. And if you didn't check out last week's video, please do. I appeared on a stream the other day in Australia with a guy called James Fox Higgins, and he's a really, really great guy. He's going to be on the show soon, but I did a really good interview with him, and amongst other things, we discussed Christianity. So you might want to check that out. We've discussed that today. Now, I would just like to say before we wrap things up, thank you to everyone who donated. If you didn't have a chance to donate or would like to donate after the show, you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. You can donate via Bitcoin, or you can donate via Entropy after the show has ended. So that is the way to contribute financially if you would like to. And that is about it for tonight. So I can't believe we finally made it. We made it to the finish line and only 2 minutes late. Not too bad going considering, but it has been a very, very good show. So I would just like to say to everyone, please do stay safe in the lockdown. And as always, thank you to everyone who gave generous donations. And also, thank you so much to everyone who's been here supporting the show tonight. The people who support this show, the viewers, this community, they are the people that give us hope. This community is what is raising everyone's spirits. Thank you so much. Stay safe. Love you all. And I'll see you again, same time, next week, for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you very much.